Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict speaks about St. Gregory the Great, the 6th century Pope and Doctor of the Church, at his weekly general audience. Burma Bishops. The bishops of Myanmar or Burma speak to us about their hopes for more democracy and about how the church there is aiding survivors in the wake of the cyclone. Under attack, we look at why Christians in India are increasingly being targeted by right-wing Hindu fundamentalist groups. And behind bars, as Britain's prison population soars to record levels, we find out more about the plight facing inmates in the nation's overcrowded and underfunded jails. Pope Benedict focused his catechesis on the figure of St. Gregory the Great, the 6th century Pope and Doctor of the Church, at today's general audience. Emma McCarthy reports.
Doctor of the Church, Pope St. Gregory the Great, who governed the Church of Rome at the end of the 6th century, was at the heart of Pope Benedict XVI's audience this Wednesday. The Pope delivered his catechesis from a raised podium sheltered from the heat of the May sun to the thousands of visitors and pilgrims in St. Peter's Square.
Born of a noble Roman family, Gregory entered the civil service, in which he rose to the dignity of prefect of the city, and then embraced the monastic life. Gregory's learning and experience and his outstanding personal gifts led to his appointment as a papal representative to the imperial court in Constantinople and then as the pope's secretary. In the year 590, Gregory was elected pope.
Pope Benedict noted that Gregory's papal ministry was marked by tireless energy and a clear vision of the grave problems facing civil society and the church.
Gregory made every effort to contain the Lombard invasion, to provide for the evangelization of that people, and to establish peace throughout Italy. In addition to his preaching, teaching, and pastoral activity, he also reorganized the management of the church's goods and ensured a more effective administration of her charitable works. At a time of great social instability, and despite his frequent ill health, Gregory proved an effective, prudent, and saintly pastor whose life and teaching continue to inspire us today.
Concluding his weekly encounter with the faithful, Pope Benedict greeted groups of pilgrims who had come from the Americas, Great Britain, and Asia, offering good wishes to participants in the Christian-Hindu symposium being held in Castel Gandolfo.
Upon all the English-speaking pilgrims, especially those from England, Scotland, Sweden, Australia, Hong Kong, India, Indonesia, Canada, and the United States, I call invoke God's blessings of joy and peace.
In Myanmar or Burma, the ruling military junta has renewed the house arrest order for the pro-democracy leader and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi. Her National League for Democracy party scored a landslide win in 1990 elections, but she was denied power by the junta. Suu Kyi has spent more than 12 of the last 18 years in detention. The Catholic bishops of Myanmar are currently in Rome on their ad limina visits. We spoke to the auxiliary bishop of Yangon, Justin So Min Tit, who told us that his country needs more democracy and freedom for its people.
The military government, according to them, they said they are preparing for democracy. So concerning with our religious freedom, to a certain extent we are free. Freedom of worship, but there are also some difficulties. We need to get democracy, genuine democracy, so that we can live freely, but we hope for the better future. As Christians, we are trying to do everything for the better future.
Meanwhile, international concern remains high for the plight of the survivors of the devastating cyclone that hit Myanmar earlier this month. The storm killed at least 78,000 people, and a further 50,000 are still missing, whilst around 5 million people have been left homeless. Myanmar's junta has been reluctant until now to allow full access by foreign aid workers to the stricken region. However, UN officials say there are signs of greater cooperation after last week's pledge by the Burmese government that all aid workers would now be allowed into the country. In the meantime, local aid groups, volunteers and faith-based organisations have been doing their best to ease the desperate plight of the cyclone survivors. We spoke with Bishop John Hisinhagi from the Diocese of Paten, one of the areas affected by the cyclone earlier this month. He gave us details of what the local Catholic Church is doing to help victims.
So the cyclone begins on the 2nd of May and ended on the 3rd of May, but the cyclone left 2 days of heavy rains and winds. So when the cyclone is over, the CBCM, the Catholic Conference of Myanmar, under the direction of the Catholic Conference of Myanmar, all the seminarians, religious and catechists are organized groups, as a different groups, to go to the field and help the people, and rescuing the people, at the same time helping the people, providing supplies and food to all these people.
We have spoken with numerous Caritas, Red Cross, other aid groups, who say the aid is, as you say, getting into the country, but it's not being distributed as it should be. How is the church coping with a shortage of aid?
Oh, yes. So for the time being, yes, we heard that many international helps already there, but on our part, on the part of the church, we have no time to wait for all the aids to reach to the people. But as far as much as we could, we tried to help with our own to the people. For example, in my diocese, but the diocese, as soon as the cyclone is over, we try to send boats. At the same time, the wireless telephones to the certain places there to have a proper communication with these people. And then we send boats to rescue the people. Together with the boats, we send the supplies and food and whatever, those who remain there. So for us in my diocese, Pathé, which is one of the affected places, so we open 5 camps as soon as the typhoon is over. So we rescue the people and keep in the camps there, different camps there, and we provide food and supplies to the people. At the same time, we provide food and other supplies to those who remain in the villages there.
And what are the greatest needs of the people at this point?
Okay, for the emergency, for the time being, they need food, shelter, medicine, and clothes for emergency needs. But after 1 month, after one month, they will need for the rehabilitations now. For example, for the time being, before I came here, I told the committee, which is already operating in my diocese, I told these people to provide machine for cultivating and also that one paddy seeds and other seeds to plant. So because the rainy season is over soon, after 1 or 2 months, man, you cannot plant anymore. So this is the time to plant all the paddies and whatever. So they don't have buffaloes and cows and other things anymore. So what they need now is the machine, cultivating machine. So I told the people to buy this machine and send to the villages as much as possible.
We know that the military junta has been in powers for 20 years now and is very difficult. What are the greatest spiritual needs of the people in your country, in Myanmar?
The people needs to be more patience like that. But and at the same time, on the part of the people, we also need to really pray for all the people. Those who are leading the countries now. We cannot just ignore them and blame them on our part. We need to also pray for them too.
What is the most important thing for all of our listeners in the world outside of Myanmar to know about the church in the country and the people of your country? If there was a message for everybody, what would that be?
The message for the people, all the people around there. Yeah, the message for people is to be able to prepare, to be able to be ready spiritually. Now, because since we do not know the time we are going to die, and we need to be always be prepared. And on the other hand, also the same things that after looking at all these things, those who become the victims of this cyclone, some were rich people, some were very poor people, but after the cyclone, all everybody became the same. They didn't have anything anymore, only the clothes on the body only. So it means that the worldly things are not last long, and we need to just prepare ourselves for the spiritual things.
I just maybe have one last question. First, for you, what is the biggest challenge today for the church in Myanmar? And secondly, what is the biggest challenge for the people of Burma?
The bigger challenge for the people in poverty, I might say that. Poverty, when I say poverty, not only material poverty, but also spiritual poverty. So this poverty is a great challenge for all the people in Myanmar.
That was Bishop John Haji from Burma speaking to my colleague Irene Lagan. Christians in India have been increasingly targets of violent attacks blamed on right-wing Hindu fundamentalist groups. The latest violence occurred earlier this month when a convent of sisters in the city of Bhopal was attacked. Some of the worst anti-Christian violence seen in India since independence occurred over the Christmas period last year in the state of Orissa, where mobs set fire to dozens of Christian churches and more than 600 houses belonging to Christians. Most of these extremist Hindu groups accuse the Catholic Church and Christian denominations of forcibly converting Hindus to Christianity, a charge denied by the Christian community. Several Indian states have passed laws banning forced conversions, and hundreds of people have been arrested on such charges over the past few years. However, Christian leaders say very few cases go to court because the conversions are found to be not forced, and therefore there's no case. Father Babu Joseph is the spokesman for the Conference of Catholic Bishops in India. He believes that these extremist Hindu groups are becoming more emboldened.
A group of right-wing Hindu fundamentalists barged into the convent of the Presentation Sisters in Bhopal, which is the capital city of Madhya Pradesh, the central part of India. The convent belonged to the sisters, the Presentation Sisters, and they were having their novitiate house there. So they had a couple of novices and the sisters and their servants. And the group of people barged into their house, broke their windows and doors, and manhandled one or the other sisters there, and they destroyed lots of their property. And of course, the sisters were traumatized by this unprovoked attack on them. And the matter was reported to the police, and the police came immediately and attended to their needs. They have arrested a couple of them who were in this group and who attacked the sisters. And the situation is now back to normal. They have also posted a couple of policemen at the convent in order to give security to the sisters. As you rightly said, this is not the first instance in that city. Particularly in Madhya Pradesh, there has been a rise in the number of incidents of attack on Christian communities, Christian personnel, particularly religious nuns and so on. And we have been certainly expressing our deep concern at the increasing number of attacks, but also unprovoked attacks on these sisters and other religious men and women. Last 4.5 years of the right-wing Hindu groups rule there, these elements have become more and more bold, and therefore they have been going about creating mayhem in several places. And this is certainly a matter of a deep concern for us, and we have also made it known to the Union government, and they also have assured a necessary protection and action against these people who are creating a problem.
Archbishop Chinath has said that
yes.
One of the reasons he's convinced that is not so much religious extremism, but because of the work that Christians have done in areas such as Orissa, in helping the very, very poor, the Dalits and the lowest in the caste system. Is that the case? Is this partly not so much coming from the problem of conversion as much as aiding those who are the poorest of the poor?
Right. I would say there are several reasons that are contributing to the prevailing situations. And one of the reasons that is, you know, behind these incidents, as Archbishop rightly said, is our work among the prior sections of India. Now, with our involvement and work among these sections of people in India, their economic and social profile also has undergone change. And this has also affected the status quo of the society, which is resented by certain sections of Indian society. We have been deploying our resources and personnel in these areas where the deprived sections of people live, and their status or their life has dramatically changed over the years. And this has been not very kindly taken by some sections, particularly those who subscribe to the right-wing ideology in India. Because one of the things this right-wing ideology groups want to sustain in this country is the status quo of the caste system or the social structure here. When that social structure and status is called into question by people who belong to the lowest strata of society and who are educated, then that kind of, you know, challenge is not at all acceptable. And therefore, I think these groups are targeted. And of course, the Christian missionaries are working among these groups. And the easiest way to tarnish the image of the Christian missionaries working among these people is that you can make allegation on them saying that the motive behind their work in these sections of people is to convert them through fraudulent means and so on, which certainly is not true at all.
That was Father Babu Joseph, spokesman for the Conference of Catholic Bishops in India, speaking to my colleague, Irene Lagan. In the UK, the prison population has soared to nearly 83,000, its highest ever recorded level. And this upward trend shows no sign of stopping. Experts say the system is stretched to breaking point with chronic overcrowding and a sharp increase in prison suicide levels. In the words of Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, the Archbishop of Westminster, prisoners are the most marginalised and forgotten people in our society. And the problems prisoners face behind bars don't end when they are released back into society. Every day, hundreds of inmates walk out of prisons in the UK with no home, no job, and no one to support them. As a result, it's distressing but hardly surprising to learn that two-thirds of former prisoners get sucked back into the world of crime. So why has there been such a dramatic increase in the number of prisoners in Britain? And what are conditions like inside the nation's jails? Well, to gain an insight, I spoke to Andy Key Downs, Director of the Prison Advice and Care Trust, a Catholic charity that provides support and help to prisoners and their families.
There are lots of reasons for the big increase in the prison population. One of them is that sentences, the judges and magistrates, have become tougher. We've also seen a greater use of what are called indeterminate sentences, which are sentences which effectively say you will stay in prison until we decide you're safe to be released. We've seen a massive increase in drugs, and drugs fuel such a massive proportion of crime, about 80% of crime, some people think. And there are some very real problems. I think we have become more punitive as a society. I think also we've seen a failure of mental health and other services in the community. Our prisons do have a lot of people in them who are mentally ill, who I believe, and many others believe, would be better cared for in therapeutic communities, in healthcare-based communities.
Another distressing reality is that two-thirds of all these prisoners re-offend within 2 years of release. Is that a figure that has remained more or less steady?
The reoffending rate, as it's called, has remained more or less steady. The government are pointing at some modest improvements in those figures, but they're pretty much steady.
Why is it so difficult for prisoners to go on the straight and narrow? What's preventing these reoffending figures from coming down?
There are a whole range of reasons why people don't carry on reoffending when they come out of prison. One is housing. One is family. One is employment. If they've got a drugs problem, that can make it almost impossible for them to cope on the outside. But if a prisoner comes out of prison with £50 in their pocket and no family to return to and nowhere to call home and no job, then, of course, the likelihood of them reoffending is extremely high. And shockingly, that is still the case for a great many prisoners leaving prison. Prison governors and the prisons in Britain do work very, very hard to provide what support they can to resettle prisoners. But the funding isn't there. The government doesn't provide anything like the level of funding or support for prisoners to resettle on release from prison.
Turning now to conditions inside, we talked about the record high number of prisoners crammed into these jails. What are conditions like for some of these inmates? Can you describe perhaps some of the most shocking or worrying conditions that you have seen?
The overcrowding of prisons is causing some really shocking problems. We're seeing Victorian jails with cells that were built to house a single prisoner, a solitary prisoner, being used for two men, or sometimes jails using prison cells for three people. We're seeing an increase again of the suicide rate amongst prisoners, particularly those prisoners when they're first received into prison. One of the things that shocks me most of all, though, perhaps, is that so many prisoners, particularly men in prison, find themselves locked up in their cells for 23 hours a day. And that can't be any way to treat a human being, and it can't be any way to help somebody rehabilitate. I think one of the most crushing things in prison is the sheer boredom of men lying on their bunks all day long, day after day. There really isn't anything like the level of support they need in terms of training and education and work inside prisons. And I think that's something that can really crush people's morale.
You talked about, in fact, the high rate of suicides. What kind of figures are we talking about here?
Well, we see a suicide rate of about 90 people per year in prisons, and that may not seem very particularly high when you look at the size of the population. But what you have to bear in mind is that is the tip of the iceberg. It's estimated that out of every suicide, there are at least two or possibly three attempted suicides where prison officers are regularly cutting men down who are trying to hang themselves from the bars of their cells or from any point that they can find to attach a rope to. Self-harm is also very prevalent, particularly in the women's prisons, women cutting themselves, hurting themselves in all sorts of ways. So the suicide rate is really it's really the tip of the iceberg. The level of self-harm and self-mutilation is very shocking, and it's almost become a sort of normal feature of life. It's not unusual to be in a prison and to hear that somebody's swallowed a razor blade or somebody's, you know, being cut down. It's really quite common.
And in this situation, how important is the figure of a chaplain?
Chaplains are vital, absolutely vital. I think particularly for Catholics, whether from England or from Ireland or from overseas, and of course we're seeing far more prisoners now coming from Africa and Eastern Europe. For them, the presence of a Catholic chaplain can make them feel that the church is there for them. You know, in their darkest hour, the church is still there, offering care and support and God's love, and it can make all the difference in the world. The chaplains save people's lives and they save people's spirits. One of the things that we do is work in a number of prisons on a prisoner's first night in custody, which is the most dangerous time. If they're going to hurt themselves, the most dangerous time is their first night, the shock of coming in. And the shock of losing their family or fearing the loss of their family is the thing that can tip many people over the edge. So we have a scheme where we simply talk to people and we listen to them. And we also look into whether their children are being properly cared for. You know, there are about 170,000 children each year in Britain who experience the imprisonment of a parent, but there's no formal support network, there's no statutory support network for them whatsoever. So that's another group of people who suffer a sentence, innocent people who suffer a sentence who we need to care for and look after.
You said that drugs are fueling a high proportion of crimes nowadays. I mean, how many, what percentage of prisoners are given help or therapy to try to kick their dependence on drugs or alcohol?
The drug programs, the drug work in prisons has got much better, and to be fair, the mental health services have got better in recent years. In some prisons, it's relatively good. I know in some women's prisons, I know of some people who will sentence women to prison knowing that they have a better chance of getting drug treatment in a prison than they would in the community. Now, that doesn't mean that treatment is available to all and is everything that it should be. What it says is how appalling it is in the community. But in many other prisons, the prevalence of drugs in prison, illegal drugs within prison, unfortunately, that does offset a lot of the efforts to detox prisoners once they're inside. Prisons are working very, very hard on this, but if you can imagine trying to run proper health care and detox programs in an overcrowded Victorian inner-city jail, it's incredibly difficult. Many of the prisons we have are not fit for purpose anymore. They need to be pulled down and they need to be broken up into smaller community-based units where people can get the kind of treatment that they need. Because we spend a fortune in incarcerating people, and as you said, two-thirds of them, sometimes as high as 90% with young offenders, will come out and will be reconvicted within 2 years. So as well as the moral and ethical argument, there's a sheer financial argument for doing this better.
You obviously have dealt with prisoners or met prisoners and helped them and their families. Is there any one particular case or one particular anecdote, be it of the prisoner or the prisoner's family, that really, in your opinion, sums up the scale of the problem or their desperate plight?
Gosh, there are so many. One that comes to mind, which is quite recent, is of a woman I met who came to us after her son was sent to prison on remand for attacking his own father. He hurt his own father very badly. Her son was on crack cocaine, had trained as a teacher, had difficulties in his personal life and got into drugs. And on one occasion he attacked his father, who was an alcoholic, so there was a lot of problems within this family. He was sent away to prison. She then tried to find him but couldn't find him because the prison she thought he'd been sent to was full. He was then transferred to another prison and then on to another prison, and she couldn't track him down. And because there wasn't the kind of service that was needed there on his first night in custody, and because he didn't ring home, he thought his family would abandon him immediately. So he didn't ring home, and she spent a month trying to find him. Meanwhile, he was on what's called suicide watch in the prison. The officers were watching him 24/7 through his cell to make sure that he was not attempting to kill himself. When she did eventually manage to track him down to the prison, it took her 5 days to get through the telephone system, which was engaged permanently, until she found him. She was then able to tell him that she forgave him and that she loved him, and he was then taken off suicide watch. 3 months later, his case went to court, and it was dismissed, and he was released. Now, for me, that's one example of what we do to vulnerable people. It's also an example of what we do to families.
Time goes by so slowly, and time can do so much.
I was speaking there to Andy Keane Downs, Director of the Prison Advice and Care Trust. Well, that's all for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.